Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for being here on this rainy evening. I'm Stesha Brandon. I'm the Literature and Humanities Program Manager here at Seattle Public Library, and I wanted to welcome you to Central Library and to tonight's event with Peter Heller. Thank you to Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to co-present tonight. We would also like to thank the author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and our media sponsor, the Seattle Times, for their generous support for library programs. Finally, we're also grateful to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Now let me turn the podium over to Rick Simonson from Elliott Bay Book Company, and he will introduce the rest of the program.
Thank you, Stesha, and thank you very much for being here. For Elliott Bay, as we got the chance when we sort of find out about what books and authors are coming out in a given period, one of the things that's been nice is to help bring back to the library writers who have been here as part of Seattle Reads. That's been the case with Dina Mengestu, with Chris Cleave, with Leila Lalami. And having Peter Heller here, we have someone who's actually here just 2 years ago when the Seattle Reads Choice was his second novel, The Painter. Peter came to Seattle, actually he came to Seattle in his earlier writing life as a nonfiction writer. He was author of four wonderfully varied nonfiction books, one way or another having something to do with the outdoors, I would say, with people's ways outdoors, natural forces at work, things. And then it was in 2013 that he came through for this debut novel, The Dog Stars, when he came to Elliott Bay. And that book received great acclaim, as did The Painter. And tonight he's here with his newly published third novel, a book entitled Celine, a book which starts out in New York City in very urban environs and actually somewhat elegant. There's some, it's, you know, some city life and city things going on. But there is also in and around the richly drawn people that are part of this book, which have been part of each of his novels, there becomes some intrigue. And then the intrigue takes its central characters from New York to the West. And again, you get great descriptions and narratives set in the West and in play. So it's writing that's strong and rich. It's tricky. I'd want to talk about it because this book actually has all sorts of elements of things that shouldn't probably be disclosed until you've read the book. It's a literary book, but I'd also say it's got the best elements of a mystery, and you'll get to hear some of that, but I have a feeling Peter knows how much to say and how much not to say. He'll read and take questions. We have copies of Celine. We also have copies of Dog Stars and The Painter here as well. And so he'll take questions, and he'll sign at this table here when all is said and done. So again, we thank you for being here, bad weather and all. And now, Ashley, please join in welcoming back to Seattle the wonderful writer, Peter Heller.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Stesha. Is that too loud? No? Okay. It's good to be back here. Wow. It's the weather sucks. But for us Denverites, it's pretty nice, actually. I'm going to read to you guys. If you've heard me before, you know I'd like to read, but I won't drub you to death. I'd really like to read the whole book to you tonight. That'd be really fun. Set some kind of Guinness Book record, but I won't. I think what I'll do is I'll read a little section just to set it up, and then I'll tell you about it a little bit. I won't read you the prologue because I think you'll probably read it. But I will read you chapter one from Celine. The call had come while she was at her workbench wiring the naked taxidermic form of an ermine onto a rock beside the skull of a crow. The plan was to have the skinless ermine looking down at his own hide tacked to the rock. Her sculpture had a distinctive dark streak. When Celine wasn't solving cases, she made pieces from anything at hand, which often involved skulls. The year before, the window washer had been fascinated by her art, which was displayed throughout the open studio, and the next day, he brought her a human skull in a bucket. "Don't ask," he said. She didn't. She covered it immediately in gold leaf, and it stood now on a pedestal by the front door, looking elegant. Now she felt like this ermine. She felt skinned and lost, without protection. Her own fur had been her family. She had Hank, of course, but a son, no matter how old, was someone to be protected, not the other way around. When the phone rang, she almost didn't answer it, but then she thought it might be Pete calling from up in the Heights, needing grocery shopping help. "Hi, Celine Watkins?" "Yes." "This is Gabriella, Gabriella Ambrosio Lamont." "Gabriella," she whispered, trying to place the name. "You don't know me. I went to Sarah Lawrence, class of 82. I saw this story about you in the alumni magazine, Prada PI. Gabriella laughed, clear, bell-like. Celine relaxed. "That was silly," Celine said. "I mean the title. I've never worn Prada in my life." "Chanel doesn't alliterate." "Right." Celine closed her eyes. The name was distinctive and it sounded familiar. Hadn't the girl had her own small story in the magazine about a show of still life photographs in a gallery in San Francisco? Celine seemed to remember a portrait of the woman in bits of biography. She was pretty, maybe partly Spanish. Her father had been a photographer too, hadn't he? Famous and very charismatic. The story had interested Celine. "I remember you from an article." "Ha, the exclusive club of the alumni magazine profiles," Gabriella said. "Yes." "Pause. I hope it's okay that I called you out of the blue." "Yes, of course." Celine had been in her business a long time. She knew that nobody ever just called out of the blue. They had been on a certain trajectory for a while. They deliberated. They picked up the phone. They were like the pilots of small planes approaching an airport who call the tower finally for instructions to land. What Celine didn't know was if she had the strength. It was 1 year and one day after the Twin Towers had fallen. She could still almost smell the char, still see the air gritty with ash, and remember how the wind blew bits of charred financial statements and post-it notes across the river where they fluttered over the dock like lost confetti. She could not have imagined a sadder finale to a grim year. Her younger sister had died that May. She remembered how bright, how tender seemed the cottonwoods along the Big Wood River in Ketchum, Idaho, the morning Mimi left. She had helped her go, the handful of pills, the long kiss on the cheek. How she had walked down the drive, how the leaves spun in the wind, and how when a gust came through, it swept the old trees to a darker green, like the hands of a harpist lifting a somber note off the strings. And then in July, she got word that her older sister, Bobby, had a brain tumor. It was a flare-up of a cancer 5 years in remission. Celine went to Pennsylvania to visit, to help, and there was not much to do, as Bobby died within 3 weeks. It was almost as if the youngest sister's death had given the eldest sister permission to take the deep rest she had longed for. And then the first plane hit, and Celine went to her window and watched the plume of black smoke rise into a clear sky. She was riveted. She lived 50 feet from the pier in an old brick loft building, kitty-corner to the River Cafe. It was almost under the Brooklyn Bridge, Brooklyn side, 30 yards from the East River, and with the windows open, she could hear the current rip and burble against the pilings of the dock. She pursed her lips and tried to get enough air. She did not move. Pete left her alone. When the second plane tore through the sister tower to the south, she shudders as if it were she herself who had been slammed and ripped. Lying in bed that night while she cried silently beside him, Pete realized that Bobby was the North Tower and Mimi the South. And of course, the collapsing buildings were much more than that, too. They were a burning message that a certain world had passed. Her sisters had been the last of the family she'd been born into. Celine's inner and outer world mirrored each other. Celine was 68 then. Her body was more frail than it should have been for an active, strong-willed woman as a result of 4 packs a day for 30 years. And she thought though she had quit 10 years ago, the smoke had ravaged her lungs. She usually refused to wear oxygen. She was too elegant or vain. And I'll skip ahead a little. Celine Watkins was a private eye. She had what Mimi called the underdog bone. Celine always rooted for the weak, the dispossessed, the children, for the ones who had no means or power, the strays and homeless, the hapless and addicted, the forlorn, the remorseful, the broken. One couldn't count the skinny, trembling dogs her son ended up loving, nor the chaotic families that stayed with them for days. The cases she took were for the lost causes, the ones who could never afford a PI. They were never about leverage or retribution or even justice, and they were often performed pro bono. They were usually about reuniting birth families. So she found the missing, the ones who could not be found. She gave a mother her lost son, a daughter her lost father, and her success rate was a staggering 96%, much better than, say, the FBI. She had worked for them, too, once, and she would never do it again. I wanted to read you that just to give a little setup so that when we talk about the book, you know, knew sort of how it starts. Her partner in investigation and all other things in the book is her husband, Pete. And Pete is a 7th-generation Maine Islander, where reticence is like the state bird. And he just doesn't say much. In the family, they call him the quiet American. But despite the fact he doesn't say a lot, he has a ton of skills. He can build a small boat, he can pitch hay, cut firewood, make a meal for 9 siblings when his mother is busy. And he channels these prodigious skills now, living there on the dock in Brooklyn, into making, trying to make his wife eat a green vegetable, which he never can. Writing memoirs about island life in Maine, and carving unabashedly erotic sculptures, which the cleaning lady refuses to dust. And the two of them are really, they're really like the good cop, bad cop as investigators, but there's sort of like the quiet cop, and then, I mean, they're like the cop that talks and the one who doesn't say anything at all. I think I'm going to just read you a scene of sort of what it's like when they're on the road together. They get this call from this young woman, and her father went missing in Yellowstone like over 20 years before, and all signs pointed to a bear mauling, but they never found the body, and this young woman believes that her father's still alive, and she'd like Celine to find him. Pete and Celine head west. They go to Denver. Celine's son, Hank, has a camper truck, and Hank is a little like me. He's like really a lot like me, actually. And he has the same camper, and they borrow it, and they head up to Wyoming. So I'll just read you a scene of them driving to Wyoming, and then I'll pretty much stop reading. But I also want to say, because I didn't say this before, that Seattle is just an awesome place to be a reader and a writer. The Elliott Bay has been supporting me as an author since my very first book, and the Seattle Library just did like this amazing thing 2 years ago. I don't know if any of you participated at all, but it's amazing. It's like Seattle is almost like being in France, where, you know, like authors are actually get respect. We were in France for a month, my wife and I, the month of September, and I just couldn't believe it. Like, people were like, you know, actually like thought novelists were really awesome. It was sort of like being Justin Bieber, you know, when you're like 57. Okay, here they are driving in Wyoming. Celine didn't really relax until they turned up into the Sweetwater Valley, and the ranges on either side got close, and their flanks were dark with timber, and the meadows were green. So were the irrigated fields of the ranches lying along the river, the neat white ranch houses peeking out from groves of boisterous cottonwoods. She opened her window and let the late afternoon wind pour in, and it smelled of alfalfa and wet fields and the river. They drove into Lander just as the sun was setting. settling into the long escarpment of the Wind Rivers. Just three more latitudes north made a difference, here at the end of September. The air pouring through the window was chilly with fall, and she could smell wood smoke. The aspen were already turning on the higher ridges, slashing the shoulders of the mountains with ochre and gold. Glorious, this time of year. It was good to be out of the city now, good to be rolling, traveling, letting her losses toss in her wake. The cold currents would bring them around again, surely, probably tonight as she slept. And if she woke up to the strange silences of a new town and lay in the dark listening, she would welcome them home and taste without bitterness the oddly sweet grief of missing those one loves. But now it was wonderful to forget for a few hours, to be traveling, to hear tires hum and thwop on cracks in the pavement, to come to a T in the road above a creek whose meadow was dotted with horses, roans, and Appaloosas, and smell smoke from the wood of trees that didn't even grow in the east. Celine didn't feel like cooking. Pa offered, but she waved him off. "Let's have ribs," she said. "Isn't that what they eat in Wyoming? And then let's go find a pullout somewhere to make our new home. I feel a little like a hermit crab." "Carrying his house on his back?" "We had one as a pet, you know. Mimi brought it home from Simmons Point one day in her glasses case. Mummy had a fit." "You were all suckers for a stray." He was not at all a stray. I'm sure she plucked him from a very fine family where he'd been quite happy. It made me mad, kind of a lesson for me in not offering help where it isn't needed. "Did you make her put him back?" "No, she was irrationally attached. At the end of the summer, I abducted him and put him right back in the little tidal pool where she'd found him. I'd been with her that day. Anyway, over the summer, he'd been quite spoiled. She dropped all manner of food into the pickle jar. One Friday night, she brought him to the movies. She swore to me that he crawled to the edge of the jar and came half out of his shell and watched. Ginger Rogers. She swore in the Bible that he moved all his little legs like he wanted to dance. She said he was an almond and wasn't allowed to dance. I finally figured out that she meant Amish. I had learned about them from our nanny, and I'd been telling her about how they don't have zippers, which she thought was hysterical. She changed Benny's salt water twice a day. When it was clear that he was actually growing, she found several empty snail shells and dropped them in. He inspected them and found them lacking. I told her that probably they couldn't have holes. She thought he'd like to have windows in his new house. Finally, she found a beautiful, glossy, symmetrical shell all covered in irregular black spots like a paint pony and with no pinholes. Benny took one look and moved right in. Years and years later, as an adult, she told me she thought of that as one of her proudest moments. Isn't that odd? Pete half smiled. It was his way of giving vigorous applause. Finally, he said, "I always thought of ribs as a Texas specialty or Louisiana, though come to think of it, Uncle Norwood could barbecue a wicked batch." "Were you even listening?" "Of course you were." His son Norwood Jr. kept a pet lobster one summer. That one didn't end so well. Ha! How could she have doubted him? Of all the things Pete Beveridge was very good at, listening was perhaps the best. "Maine ribs," she said. "You know, Pete, I've been cutting you slack all afternoon. I'm supremely aware." This was how they sparred. It was a call and response, a little like the cries red-tailed hawks screed across a valley to their mates. "Are you there?" "Yes, I am here." They passed the Pronghorn Lodge and came down the hill onto Main Street, a straight mile-long prospect of mostly late 19th century brick buildings with tall front windows and ornate front doors. They passed the Lander Grill and the Noble Hotel and two outdoor sports shops with tents and fleeced-up mannequins in the windows. They passed a Loaf and Jug and the Safeway and a gas station-turned-burger joint and two stores featuring Native American crafts. It was this time of day or night that happens only a few weeks a year at a certain hour in certain parts of the American West. The sun sets behind mountains, but the cloudless sky that is more than cloudless, that is lens clear, clear as the clearest water, holds the light entirely, holds it in a bowl of pale blue as if reluctant to let it go. The light refines the edges of the ridges to something honed, and the muted colors of the pines on the slopes, the sage-roughened fields, the houses in the valley, the colors pulse with the pleasure of release, as if they know that within the hour, they too will rest. Maybe Celine thought this way because she was exhausted. She was. It had been a long time since she'd driven that far in a day. Main Street curved to the right, and they passed the Double Lot Motel, which made them laugh, as there were probably patrons doing things there they doubly ought not to do. And Celine abruptly threw the wheel over and executed a U-turn that startled Pa and squealed the tires. "Practice," she smiled. 27 miles per hour, pretty good. Didn't even think about rolling," she grinned. "Never know when we might need one of those. I was thinking we ought to head back to the Lander Grill. They might not have ribs, but I bet they serve a mean steak." So the secret of this book is that it's about my mom. And I wrote the book. My mom died 2.5 years ago, and I was very close with her. And I wrote her as closely as I could. It's not that Celine is really based on my mom. It's that it is my mom. And I mean, I tried as a writer. I mean, Flannery O'Connor said that, you know, a writer's always trying to capture the sea turtle. It's always swimming off into the green, aqueous, you know, distance, and they never can get it, because it's never good enough for the writer. And I felt that way. I felt like I missed her essence. But other people who've read it, you know, thought it was pretty good in terms of capturing her. And I sent it to Pete, who actually is still alive. He lives in that same loft building right there on the dock. And he's writing his memoirs about Maine Island life. And he's a very interesting dude. And I talk about this in the book. He went to Harvard, and he was a card-carrying communist in 1952, when it could really screw with your prospects. And when he got out of school in 1954, he married a black woman and became editor of the Liberator publication in New York City, which was a major civil rights publication. And the letters from his parents and his seven uncles and aunts telling him not to come back to North Haven with his Negro wife are some of the most compelling letters I've ever read, because they love Pete so much. He was sort of like the golden child. He was an athlete. He was very caring. He was community-minded. Everybody loved him, but the letters are so convoluted and twisted, and that these are smart, rhetorically agile people writing these letters, sort of saying, "We don't want you to bring her back or come back again to the island until you've got, you know, your head clear. But it's not because we're racist; it's because we love you." So, anyway, Pete is as written in the book too, and I sent the manuscript to Pete, and he. 2 days later, I got a call, and he said, I read the book. I was like, okay. And then he said, I have two criticisms. And I kind of sat up, because when he says that, you know, you listen. And he said, you know, she would have never gone out to meet the assassin in anything but full face. She would have put on all her makeup. And I didn't, you know, I just had her, like, put her Glock under her robe and go. Wrong. And he also said, she never took my arm. We always held hands. I was just like, oh, wow. They were so romantic. I mean, she died when she was 80. And he was, like, 85. So anyway, my mom grew up in Paris during the war, and she was 7 when the Germans were coming hot, you know, into Paris. And she and her two sisters and her mother fled. And her father worked for Morgan's Bank, and his name was Harry Watkins. And he fled. He left as they were really coming right into the city. And my grandmother told me that when my mother got to Manhattan, all she talked about was joining the French Resistance, and she was 7. That's what she wanted to do. And she would go around, my grandmother told me that she would go around New York, like, listening to conversations and trying to decide who was a Nazi spy. And so she kind of grew up wanting to be like James Bond, and you know, she grew up in the 50s in New York, and she got married right out of college, and She had me, and I kind of like probably ruined her dreams of a promising career in the CIA or whatever she wanted to do. But once I came along a little bit, and my two sisters, she started working for a detective agency, and she got her PI license, and almost immediately on getting her PI license, the FBI called her up. And they said, asked her if she would help them find a guy who had perpetrated a large bank fraud on the Bank of New York. And he was somewhere in southern Connecticut, and they wanted someone who could go up there and find him and kind of mingle with the crowd around, you know, Greenwich and stuff. And they didn't have anyone. So Mom went up. Mom made a couple of phone calls and thought she found him. And she drove up there in her old Volvo, and she found this, like, horse property in southern Connecticut. She spied on him with her opera glasses. I'm not making this up. And then he left. You know, imagine white rail fencing and this nice, you know. And he got in his sports coupe and, you know, pulled out. And so she chased him. They had this car chase, and she was in her old Volvo. And I can imagine this high-speed chase through, like, Darien at 40 miles an hour. And finally the guy, he just pulled over because he was like, you know, who is this little woman who can barely see over the steering wheel? And why is she following me in this old car? And he pulled over, and she, like, got out. This is true, and this is in the book. Clack, 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 her little pumps, you know, on the comes over, and she says, Franklin, what you're doing is wrong, and it's not good for you, it's not good for your family, and you need to make this right. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to follow you back to the house, and then you, then we'll drive together back down to the Bank of New York, and we'll get this thing sorted out. And he did, because her moral authority was so strong, something that I experienced often as a child. the doubly ought, what you ought not to do kind of thing. So anyway, and she said she never did perps again after that, because his face, when the special agents put the cuffs on him, she said she never wanted to see that face again. And she felt like it wasn't worth it, you know. She had periods in her life where she would go off, and I wouldn't know. Nobody really knew what she was up to. And later, it was sort of fun having those things revealed, whatever she was doing. Once, when we went to say goodbye to my aunt, her youngest sister, you know, as written in here, in Idaho, we went up to say goodbye to her, and we were both very sad, and we were driving down the road, and we weren't saying much, and we were driving through Haley, Idaho, and she said, hey, Pete, pull over, will you? And there was a sign, it said, Roop Guns, Discount Guns. Okay. So we pulled in, and Mom got out, and she went in, clack, 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 scarf, earrings, right? And the guy at the counter was cleaning a handgun. He had it on a cloth, and he was, like, watching her. She came up to the counter, and she started looking, and she said, oh, could I see that one, please? And it was a honking Colt 45 automatic. And the guy said, you know, you might want to start with something a little smaller. I mean, is that a gift? And she goes, no, it's for me. He said, yeah, I think you might want to start with like a 22. And just the look she gave him. I mean, you know, I knew that how arch it was. He probably didn't. She said, but I'd like to see that one, please. So he took it out, and I could see him, you know, kind of like probing a tooth, you know, just like. And she took it, and she made a stance at the wall. And then it was like a thought bubble over the guy's head. I could see he was thinking, you know, pretty good stance. She must watch a lot of cop shows. And then he was so intrigued, he looked at his watch and he said, hey, it's 25. I was going to close up in a few minutes anyway. Let's go shoot this thing. So we got into Dick Roop's old Bronco, and we drove up above Haley. We went into this like little valley. It was like a little gully. And there was a clearing there with a fire pit and a bunch of bottles and cans and stuff and like a berm. And he set up a log and put like seven bottles and cans on the log. And then he went over and he said, okay, look, this is how you rack it. And, you know, we don't want to shoot our toes off. And, you know, and it's going to be heavy and it's going to have some kick. And she was, like, very polite, you know. And then, you know, she racked it. And then she lifted it up and just went, bam, 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 bam. And it's like glass and cans flying. Just like beautiful. It was like three shots, pause, two shots, you know. And his face, I will never forget, like Norman Rockwell could not have done his face justice. I mean, he was just like, he was like, and then he was like so respectful after that. He was like, called her Caro and, you know, and he modified the grips for her. But she had this, she was a real badass. I mean, she had this, you know, she was always revealing herself to me. And it's odd for, I think, a young man to think of his mother as, like, leading a more interesting life than he does. It's sort of an inversion of, you know, how it should be. And it may be one of the reasons that, you know, maybe it's one of the reasons I became, like, this adventure writer and everything. It's like, because, you know, I mean, I had this mom doing this stuff. And so it is about her, and the book is about, you know, in a lot of ways it's about little girls losing their dads and mothers losing their children. But I thought what I'd do now is I'm going to read one last paragraph at the end, but the funnest thing is to take questions from you guys. I know from being here before that you guys aren't, it's not like Maine. You guys aren't shy, so if you have any questions, I would love to field them. That's where the best stories come from. I'll just drink my latte. Yeah, she was. I mean, they reunited over, Pete and Mom reunited over 100 birth families, and they did most of it pro bono, all of it, I think. I mean, they found a friend of mine when I was living in Paonia, Colorado, this little town. I didn't know that, I mean, you find this stuff out, but you know, a lot of people don't have very interesting family histories, obviously. And this is one of my best friends in this little town. I didn't know that he had lost contact with his father when he was like 12. And he asked my mom and Pete to find him. And they found him in New Orleans. He was an Elvis impersonator in New Orleans. And Bill called him up and, you know, they met. And I guess it didn't go that well. I think half the time it goes well and people, you know, feel like that something that was missing, you know, they're made whole. But the other half of the time, it's like not so great. So, yeah. No, I think it was a little bit later. Like, so I was born in 59 and I would have been like, I think she started working for the detective agency when I was like 13. So it would have been in the early 70s. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, she had this interesting, like, the thing about my mom was that she could meet anybody where they lived, you know, and it was extraordinary. It's an extraordinary graciousness and respect that she gave everyone wherever she went. And so, you know, she could, you know, sometimes the people she was looking for were homeless or, you know, she could go to a homeless shelter and talk to people and those people would open up to her because, you know, she was, and, you know, she could talk to anybody. It's pretty cool. Her memorial was really awesome because there were people from all walks of life, you know. Yep. Oh, she'd be so tickled, you know. I mean, I wish she were around for lots of reasons, but I so wish she could read this. And you know, I want to believe, you know, that she's like up there, you know, like psyched about it. I was really glad that Pete really loved it, you know, because he's a savvy person, and he, you know, he really really liked it a lot. So let's see, they haven't read it yet. I think they're a little nervous. We'll see how that goes. I'm going back to read in New York in a few days. They all live there. So we'll see what happens. Yeah, yeah. Well, my mom was from this patrician family. You know, she didn't really have to. You know, she had money, and Pete had money. So Pete, who's not my father, my parents got separated when I was like 23, But Pete had worked very hard as an interior architect for Wall Street, you know, big buildings, which is an interesting thing to do as a communist. But he did that, and he made really good money, and you know they were fine. They weren't well, you know, super well off, but they had enough money to get by, and they just felt like there's a whole bunch of people. I mean, it's more probable that someone who gets their kid taken away when they're 15 can't afford an investigator, and so she felt like there was a whole bunch of people that really needed this service, and. You know, they would go into county courthouses and stuff where there were sealed records, and you know, the clerk would meet my mother in the bathroom and slide a file like from stall to stall. You know, stuff like that. I mean, it's like you can't make the stuff up because people were, you know, they just wanted to help and so. No, there were women private detectives, but not that many. I mean, because you think about it, I mean, the private detective, the cliche is the Marlowe thing, you know, it's like the tough PI with a bottle of whiskey in the drawer and all that. And but when she was working at the detective agency, there were more and more women applying because they really needed them. I mean, they needed people who could, you know, impersonate, you know, women, you know, stuff. Yeah. The best story that didn't make it into the book was when I was home on a vacation or just visiting, and she got a job from the Polish embassy to track down a little Polish girl that had been kidnapped and brought to the States by a member of her family. And her mother really wanted her back, and the Polish embassy somehow got wind of my mom and hired her. And we were there, you know, my girlfriend and I were there, and so we asked if we could go along and maybe help. So I remember parking, same old Volvo. I mean, that thing must have like 380,000 miles on it. Parked on this street in Queens, and it was a cold day, and there was the house. It was like this two-story brick house, and it had a little video camera and everything. And that's where we thought that the little girl was. And Mom and Pete were like, how should we do this? Maybe... let's see if there's, we just need evidence that the kid is there. So they gave my girlfriend and I a plastic, they had a plastic bag in the back, in the trunk, a big trash bag. And they said, why don't you guys go pretend that you're collecting clothes for little kids for the winter, for, you know, some church. So we went and we knocked on the door, you know, it was this very thick Polish accent. It was like, you know, can I help you? Sort of skeptical. And we said, you know, we're collecting clothes for St. Anne's Episcopal Church and Brooklyn, you know, for, especially for little kids, you know, we're really looking for, you know, sizes like, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old. And the woman, you could hear the pause, and then she was like, okay, 1 minute. And she handed out this whole bag full of little girls' clothes, you know, 6-year-old clothes. And this woman, you know, by the record that they researched, didn't have any kids. And that was enough for the judge to order a warrant. And again, it's like, you know, those things you do that, you know, that keep you up at night. Mom said that when she brought the little girl, somehow she ended up bringing the little girl to the Polish embassy. This very handsome Polish man with a big mustache, like looked like a cavalry officer. You know, he was one of the attachés, you know, came out. It was a marbled hall, and he came out and he took the little girl's hand. And the little girl was like looking back at Mom, and she, you know, and it's like, you know, after that, I was like, I wondered, did we do a service? You know, I mean, here she was in this country; she was probably with her aunt. I don't know. I mean, that little girl's life changed forever. Maybe that was not the right thing to do. I don't know. I didn't put that in the book. So yes, yeah. So he asked, you know, how do we get these stories? You know, they're so detailed and stuff. You're close with a dinner conversation or. You know, sometimes I would come home because I lived in the West, right? I was like the remittance man. I mean, I was the guy who went West and, you know, made a new life and wanted nothing to do with New York City and stuff. And but so I would come home, and it was very special, you know, having that reunion. And you know, Mom would say, you know, tell me very excitedly about a case that she had just worked on, or you know, or when she was in the airport. You know, once I came home, she said, Yeah, I was, you know, I was heading up to Maine on this case, you know, Penobscot Pete, or Paul, Penobscot Paul. That was a famous case. It didn't make it in the book. And I had my Glock, and I had to, and it was in my check-in, and I had my roller bag, and she was rolling her roller bag along in LaGuardia, and all of a sudden a hand came and grabbed it and said, allow me, ma'am, I'll help. And it was Bruce Willis. And, you know, and so they got to the counter and, you know, he asked her what she did. And he was very intrigued that she was a detective. And then she had to declare her Glock, you know, to the people at the counter. Bruce Willis, you know, he like just cracked a smile. And she said it was like the smile he gives when he, you know, the nice one, not the one before he blows you away, you know. And then he gave a card and said, you know, if you were your husband or ever in, you know, in L.A., you know, look me up. You know, maybe you thought they'd make a good movie. And when she got to Maine, the Glock was gone because they had made such a big issue. You know, there was such a crowd around Bruce Willis and there was the gun and everything. So she always told me after, and this is in the book, but she always said, you know, fame is a trap. And if you do anything really well and, you know, happen to be really, really good at it, you know, just don't let too many people know about it, because you know, it just causes a lot of fuss and bother, and your gun doesn't show up with you in Portland, Maine. So, anyway, yeah, I'll take a couple more. Right, I found it very easy, just because you know, the dialogue was at hand. You know, I never had to think about what they would, because it's just what they, you know, what they talked about. It's how they talked, and yeah, I found it easy. And you know, of course, I didn't put in. You know, I mean, I think, you know, I think sometimes that my family was a little rough when I was around 14. My mom stopped drinking right around then. And so when there was, you know, everybody in the house was drinking, it wasn't that fun. You know, I didn't just allude to that. I didn't put that in there. But that might be in the next Celine Watkins mystery, because we should probably tell it all. I don't know. Yeah. 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 Yeah, I use something. I know there are writers in the room, and I'll just say this one thing before I close with this reading. But the greatest thing, like the biggest help in writing novels, which are like marathon. I mean, writing a novel is like running a marathon. It's not like writing. I came up writing magazine articles, and you know they're pretty fast. Writing a novel is day after day after day after day, and you know, sort of you just you know, aggregate and. What I found, I heard that Graham Greene wrote 500 words a day every day of his life. And he kept a subtotal in the margin of his notebook. He was so assiduous about it that when there was before word counters, when he hit 500, he quit. In the middle of a dialogue, in the middle of a sentence, in the middle of dialogue, in the middle of a love scene and end of the affair, he would quit. And I read that and I thought, wow. That's not what I do at all. You know, and none of my author friends do. All my author friends and me, you know, and I, we write 500 words a day or 1,000 or whatever our quota is that we're comfortable with. But if we're on a scene, you know, and it's exciting, we'll write through the scene. We'll write 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, you know, we'll write it. And then, you know, go, phew. That's done. That was fun, and go on with the rest of our day. But if you think about it, when you come back, that's a transition, right? That's a double return. That's white space. So when you come back to your work the next morning, you are looking at white space, and you might as well start the book over again. You've got to get the ball, the rock rolling up the hill again. And so I thought, well, what Graham Greene is doing by having this arbitrary number that he's very disciplined about is not only is he's nurturing, you know, he's rationing his energy and garnering his energy, but he's also stopping in the middle, because that word 500 is likely to be in the middle of something. And so what I did was I modified it to the Heller modified Graham Greene method. And what I do is I write 1,000 words a day, but when I pass word 1,000, I go for a little while in time right in the middle of something exciting, in the middle of a scene. If it's an essay, it's in the middle of a thought I'm excited about. And then I stop. So it might be 1,060 words. But what it does for me is that it makes me so excited to get up the next morning and finish that part. And, you know, other people, you know, Hemingway used to, you know, write a few lines for the next day. It's a similar kind of thing. I like having it be right in the middle of something furious. And it changed my relationship with my work, like absolutely changed it, so that, you know, I would hop out of bed in the morning like, oh, I'm so excited to get to work. And I got so sort of excited about it, I proselytized. Now all my poor writer friends do it too, because they got tired of hearing me talking about it. But it really works. Is there one more burning question yet? Yeah. What do you mean by reporting it, the novel? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, like research. Okay, so I will confess, I mean, the reason that I write fiction now, and probably will never write, like, I've been, so this novel launched just 3 days ago, and so I've just done a couple of readings, and one question I got both times was, like, how come you didn't write a memoir about your family, and, you know, write nonfiction? And it's simply because I hate doing research. I just like to make it up. I mean, once you make everything up, it's like so fun. Like, why would you go back? You know, it's like so free. Because I was a reporter for so many years. I mean, I was a journalist for so many years. And often I was writing about controversial things, you know, like fracking in Colorado, or, you know, the oil spill in Louisiana, or the dolphins in Taiji. And you better get it right, because someone will sue your ass. And they'll sue the magazine, and there goes your reputation and all that. And so I was very, very careful to get everything right. I always wrote down. I never made up what people said. Like, if I was on some, you know, expedition type thing, you know, if, say it was like the raid on Taiji, Japan, with a dolphin, I wouldn't wait till that night to write, you know, what people said. I would write it in my notebook right then. I met John McPhee, the great, great, great nonfiction writer, and he told me that's what he did. While he's hiking, he's writing, you know. So I did that because I wanted to make sure I got it right. There's nothing worse than seeing yourself quoted and seeing a line that you know you would never say. And it's the same thing, you know, with all the politics or the details of, you know, whatever story I was writing. I triple fact-checked, and, you know, it was always, like, watertight. And it takes a lot of energy, and it's like, you know, I'm not really interested in doing that. I'd much rather just make up great stories. And so, you know, I wanted to write my mom really closely, and I used a lot of, you know, all the family history and her backstory is true, but what I did was I conflated stories between her two sisters and her. Like, there's a sailing scene in here that's kind of crazy and fun. That happened to her sister, not her. Another major thing that happens in the book I won't tell you, but one of the most major thing actually happened to her sister, her older sister, not her. You know, so in fiction, there's all that freedom, and it's just so fun. And so, and I write about things that I love and tend to know about. So far, that's what I've been doing. So, like with Dog Stars, I really didn't have to do much research. I mean, my research amounted to going out with a Navy SEAL and shooting a sniper rifle. And I was like, holy cow, that guy could blow someone's head off from a mile away without even sweating it. You know, I mean, that really made an impression on me. But that was the extent of research, you know, and so, anyway. Okay. I'm going to read this last paragraph, and thanks so much for coming out on this cold, rainy night. The saddest part was that parents would keep disappearing, and children would cry themselves to sleep night after night for months, for years, and that mothers would have their babies taken from them before they had a chance to smell the tuft of soft hair, their ears, before they had a chance to say, oh, how I love you, forever and ever. That the baby was taken before she had a chance to kiss her and wrap her properly in her arms. Pete guided her around a deep pothole, partly filled with gravel, and she gripped his hand more tightly. In the wan light from the motel sign, she could see their truck, the only vehicle in the drive, the only guess. At the end of the street, she could see the dark bulk of the baronet rising against the night sky. Yes, sad, how it felt. She thought that one might not make a dent in the great sadness, but one could help make another person whole. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.